Okay, folks, we're going to start the class on Wordsworth. Things were so frantically busy at the conference that I was at that I was unable to record a podcast. Quiet, please. And so we're going to try as much as we can to get the essence of Wordsworth today. If we don't get it all, we will. I'll try to record a podcast about the more detail, because I don't want to screw up the syllabus too much. I think we can do it. So first, Old Man Travelling is a lyrical ballad. Let's start with that. Little hedgerow birds that peck along the road, regard him not. He travels on, and in his face, his step, his gait, is one expression. Every limb, his look and bending feature all bespeak a man who doesn't move with pain, but moves with thought. He is insensibly subdued to settled quiet. He is one by whom all effort seems forgotten, one to whom long patience has such mild composure given that patience now does seem a thing of which he hath no need. Beautiful handling of the iambic pentameter, don't you think? The blank verse, beautifully handled. Yeah, he's an incredible... his prosody, which is the poet's ability to put words together, syntax, lineation, rhyme, rhythm, all that stuff, is marvellous, yeah? He is by nature led to peace so perfect that the young behold with envy what the old man hardly feels. I asked him whither he was bound, and what the object of his journey. He replied, "Sir, I am going many miles to take a last leave of my son, a mariner, who, from a sea fight, has been brought to Falmouth, and there is dying in a hospital." Kapow. Wordsworth is a poet who puts the kapow at the end of his poem. He pulls you in, and then he kind of tweaks the point of view. Sometimes he tweaks the focalization so that it's sort of too late. You're already kind of hypnotized, caught in the poem. It's a strategy that's a little bit similar to what we saw with Coleridge of the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Right? It is an ancient mariner. That first... two words of the poem imply that the poem has already begun before the actual poem starts. There is already an ancient mariner, right? That's the provocation. The poem is already there, this person is already there, right? In order to have the aesthetic experience, there has to be existence. In fact, there has to be coexistence. This coexistence is uncanny, disgusting a little bit, horrifying a little bit, strange a little bit. In order to have beauty, there has to be that. There has to be the uncanny. There has to be coexistence. A kind of uneasy, anxious quality evoked by the simple use of the word it. It is. The little hedgerow birds that peck along the road regard him not. Regard him not. Wordsworth is using him like Coleridge is using it. All of a sudden, somebody is there. The end of the second line, there's a person. The close-up, as it were, is on the birds, the little hedgerow birds. But there's always already a person there. By the end of the sentence, you realize there's a human being. He's almost not noticeable. In the sentence itself, he's not noticed by the birds, but he's also not noticed by you. He's just there. He's just there. Right? Like the ancient mariner, he's just there. In front of that church, you have to deal. He's just there. Merely there. When you analyze imagery, because this is an image, right? When you analyze imagery in your close reading, when you do that, first thing you have to establish is, are there images that are... what kinds of image do we have? Do we have imagery positive, absolutely present? Or is the imagery kind of virtual, vague, or even negative? not negative meaning hostile, but negative meaning like the negative of a photo or the drawing of a jar drawn by outlining the background around the jar. If you draw with charcoal, you can draw a shape by drawing the outline. The shape is there, draw around it, shade around it. Wordsworth does that. This is a kind of virtual image. The old man is already there before you see him, right? We see the birds around him. We see the birds pecking along the road. And this was question of the day, I think. So I wanted to get some responses on that at some point. As I call up the database, we'll just keep going with this. He's just there. He just exists. Yeah? Romantic poetry is trying to confront us with something underneath our understanding. Something underneath just decorative flowery language. Right? It's trying to confront us with something, some other dimension. But we can't directly see that dimension, so you have to kind of sidle up to it. Can't directly see it. All you can see, the only way you can see it is in a kind of anamorphic. Anamorphic means distorted, right? Unshaping. Ana means un, morphic means shape. An unshape, right? It's easy to do now. You have Photoshop, you can take an image, stretch it, bend it. It's like trying to see the fourth dimension. You can't directly see it if you're a 3D person. If you're a stick person, you can't directly see the third dimension. You have to infer it from evidence. If an apple appeared in a 2D person's world, it would first of all just be a dot. Then the dot would expand into a circle. Then it would contract again into a little dot and disappear as it passed through the 2D person's world. In the same way, in this poem, the person is already there, the depth of this person, right? Not just this guy, not just this pair of pants, right? But this guy as a person, right? This guy who has inner space. How do you evoke inner space? You can't directly, because every time you describe somebody directly, you're evoking outer space. Imagine changing the image to something more positive. There was an old man, and he was travelling down the road, and he had a seersucker suit on, and a pair of clown shoes, and a tennis racket. Totally different, if you do it that way. Right? This way is the Jane Austen way. It's the minimalist way, right? How does it work? Your own anxiety, which is your own inner space, locks onto the uncertainty in the text, and starts to fill it in. Like when Jane Austen uses untagged indirect speech, your inner space locks onto, you know, is that Kermit the Frog thinking this? Is that me thinking this? Is that the narrator thinking this? I can't tell. Your own inner space fills out the implied inner space in the narrative. That's why Jane Austen characters are so compelling. You feel like you're living them virtually. In the same way, right away, already we are thinking about this old man. Right? But we're not thinking about this old man in any particular way. We're not thinking he's old. We're not thinking that he's a man. We're not thinking that he's come from hospital. All those details are filled in later. First of all, we just have the mere existence. Right? The inner space. Yeah? A kind of abyss. Right? Walking towards us, surrounded by these birds, is a kind of abyss. Right? A kind of, like a sort of mirage, right? The old man distorts the road and the birds around him like a kind of mirage. He's not quite there, right? He just is this kind of slight distortion of everything else. He travels on, and in his step, his face, his step, his gait is one expression. Every limb, his look and bending figure, all bespeak a man who does not move with pain, but moves with thought. Right? So he's walking thoughtfully, you could say, but there's a sort of extra information in there that's kind of telling you it's not just about him walking carefully, it's about his inner space. He's thinking as he moves, he's preoccupied, he's got one kind of, he's got an inner space, we don't know what it is, we just know that he has it. He moves with thought. He moves with thought, he's walking mindfully. You ever see people walking mindfully? Maybe I'll teach you walking meditation. Walking is essential to romantic poetry for various different reasons. And when people do walking meditation, they walk very slowly compared to how we normally do. Mindfully, that means moving with thought, right? It's quite disturbing to see it. You know, it's disturbing in the same way that Occupy is disturbing. It's just existing. Right? What's disturbing about Occupy from the right wing and the left wing point of view? It's just existing in public space for no reason. Right? What's disturbing about this guy? He's just walking. Right? Right now in the poem, we don't even know where he's going. He's not really going from A to B yet. That's the point of walking meditation. You're not trying to get anywhere. You're trying to meditate via walking. Because underneath getting from A to B, there's just walking. So the physicality of that, yeah, the physicality of his existence is estranged, right? It's not completely objective. It's kind of open and weird, right? He moves with thought. His physical movement has a kind of uncanny openness to it. He is insensibly subdued to settled quiet. Yeah? He's not absorbed in where he is. Right? Like an apple passing through a 2D world, he's not stuck in that world. He's just moving through the world. Right? Like the beta effect. You know the beta effect? Gestalt psychology, when you switch on your iPhone, you switch on your computer, the little circle looks like little kind of flashing lights going round. Nothing's happening actually, there's just a light that flashes under a tenth of a second, but because the way your neurons are, you perceive that as movement. It's the beta effect. Nothing's happening, it's just that it's as it were a space is being shuffled around a set of pixels, right? Like when you see a moving LED display, it's not really moving. It's just this one, this one, this one, this one, this one, this one. But you perceive movement because the space between the lights changes. Right? In a way, the old man traveling is a kind of moving space. Right? It's like a crack in reality that's moving. Yeah? Remember Kant? Kant's big, slightly scary insight. There is a crack in reality. We can measure things, but how do you know what measurement is? Right? Well, it's numbers, but what are numbers? What is number? Right? I can point to numbers in particular, I can use my fingers to count, but I can't access the bit of me that knows what number is in the first place, the condition of possibility of me being able to measure at all. So all of a sudden, even though this world seems perfectly understandable and I can measure it and I'm a Newtonian physicist and everything's working, there is a gap in it. A kind of hole in it, right? Wordsworth is kind of animating that hole. Yeah, it's the old man is like a hole moving through the world. You know, you ever do quantum physics? When an electron pops out of a crystal lattice, there's an electron and an electron hole pair. The hole is not a real; it's a virtual particle, right? It's actually just the gap between particles where a particle could be, and this hole moves, unquote, but it doesn't really. It's just that other particles shuffle in to fill that gap. Like if you guys were to do musical chairs and just kind of keep moving, it would look as if an empty chair was moving down the room if you did it, you know, very, very fast. Right? The old man is a moving hole. Yeah? He is by nature led to peace so perfect that the young behold with envy what the old man hardly feels. You know, he seems really together. He's together. He's mature. He's not really, doesn't feel like that on the inside. He's just a guy. But he looks cool from the other's point of view, right? There's a gap between who he is and how he is perceived, right? He doesn't feel together. In fact, he's going to tell you quite shortly that he's totally blown away. I mean, imagine your own son is dying. He went off to fight in the Napoleonic Wars. This is a war poem, right? This is a war poem that creeps up on you. If the poem was called War Poem, or, you know, fuck William Pitt, he's a wanker, you wouldn't read it. You'd automatically have resistance to it. But instead, he brings you in, right? And by the end of it, oh, wow, he's got grief. This is the whole reason why that I'm seeing this, is because this guy is walking, he's totally immersed with grief, right? And he's got to get to his son, who's dying in this hospital. He's only got legs to do it. He's going to keep on walking all day, right? Before carriages, before cars. If you didn't have that much money, you have to walk, right? Coleridge and Wordsworth would walk many tens of miles a day, quite famous for doing it. Hazlitt and Wordsworth and Coleridge used to spend all their time walking to each other's houses. You know, we're talking 12, 15, 20 miles, you know, in a day, just on average. You know, over the hill, under the, you know, through the forest, over the stream, up the hill, down, round. Yeah. So, yeah. This is actually a war poem. It's the best kind of war poem because it creeps up on you from the middle of your ordinary everyday space, right? We're kind of insensitized to it right now because there's been this war going on for over a decade. Yeah, Afghanistan, Iraq just finished, right? But somewhere at the back of your head, it's still happening. You know, if you get newspapers, the newspaper comes to your house, somewhere on the front page or the second page or the third page, there's like war stuff, right? If you get your newspaper, you're in Jane Austen world, you're in the lower gentry, you get the morning paper or the weekly whatever, somewhere in the columns on the front page, there's going to be the Napoleonic War information. Right, the war with France. It's happening, right? It's happening to everybody. It's not just this thing that's happening in Afghanistan. It's happening inside of you. It's happening on your breakfast table, right? It's like that Pink Floyd song, Brain Damage. You know, the lunatic is in the hall, right? The paper holds their folded faces to the floor, and every day the paper boy brings more, right? These nutters who are in charge of our reality right now are in your house. They're in the paper, you know. It's that uncanny moment in Lost Highway where a mystery man shows up with a big smile on his face and he goes, I'm in your house right now. Call me, you know. It's like that. It should slightly scare you. Yeah, the war is already there in the poem before it's mentioned. Everything about that whole reality is distorted. Right, there's not soldiers with guns shooting each other right there in that road with those birds. They're there anamorphically. It is like another dimension of reality that permeates that road, the quietness of it, with a kind of weird, uncanny, but it doesn't totally connect with it. Right? That's why this is so genius. Right? Because Wordsworth is saying, look, connect the dots, guys. This war is sort of everywhere and nowhere. It affects how people walk down the road in some sunny country lane. It affects the way your feet touch the ground, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles away. Everything you do, all of a sudden, is distorted. Yeah? Like the gravity. You know, like everything you do is kind of because of gravity. In a way, everything that's happening in this poem is the gravitational pull of this gigantic event that's going on called the war with France, right? But you don't see gravity directly. What you see are objects falling. What you feel are your feet being pulled to the ground, but you cannot see gravity in the same way you can't see the war directly, right? If you were a four-dimensional being, you could probably see the space-time distortion, right? That is gravity. It's just a distortion of space-time. Yeah? Distortion of space-time caused by objects. The same way the war is a distortion of social space. You can't see it directly, but you can see the distortion. Brilliant, yeah? Okay, so how's the question phrased? Explain the phrase peck along the road. Okay. Let's see. Estefania, peck along the road. Yes. They're slowly looking for something. They're slowly searching for something. That's pretty good. Okay. Let's see. Let's ask somebody else. Cynthia Barrett. Peck along the road. Cynthia Barrett? Christine Bates. Peck along the road. Yes. Good. Good. Yes. That's good that you trust that, because actually that's one secret about how to read a poem. There's a certain kind of lack of understanding that it's not just ignorance, there's information for you coming from the poem. And the more you get into graduate work, the more you have to trust that. Sometimes things are opaque, and the opacity is actually important information, right? So peck along the road is a little bit opaque, right? So part of the image is that it's hard to grasp, right? Did you have any other thoughts about it? That's almost good. Do you want to kind of walk us through, or peck along that thought process? Right. Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Okay, good. Okay. Russell Booker, peck along the road. Yes. Right. Ah.
And that the birds can be normal people, and how circumstances such as the old man aren't necessarily seen.
Interesting. Okay, so you've got a syllogism going here. Yeah. Bird is to road as I is to line of verse, right? Or as narrator's pen is to line of verse. The poem is of road, right? Your eye is a bird that pecks along it, right? And when you peck, Pecking is eating. No one said that yet. Pecking is eating. It's not walking. Right? The little birds that walk along the road would be a little easier to understand. Peck along the road, right? And pecking goes like this, right? Peck, 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 right? It's a discontinuous, quantized process. They sample the road at a certain rate, right? Like your MP3, right? It's sampled at 48 megahertz, right? Or kilohertz, actually. Sorry, megahertz would be insane. 44 kilohertz, 44,000 times a second. The sampler opens the gate, takes a little tiny photograph of the sound, right? So when you analyze it really, really, really close up on a computer, you look at an MP3, it's just open gate, open, open, open. If you get it down to that level, it's just a series of clicks. Like my sound of my voice when you hear it, the MP3. If you were to analyze the waveform, you know, from a distance it looks like that, right? But when you get down to that level, it's silence, click, silence, click, silence, click, right? So there's a lot of gaps, is my point. The pecking along the road implies a kind of space that it doesn't talk about. So there is already this space in the line, actually, before even the old man, who is a kind of space, right? He's like a moving hole, remember? The description itself suggests, in the negative, in a virtual way, a kind of space. You know, it's as if the birds are like analyzing the road. They're pecking along it. right? But if you were to put a little dot where all the pecs were, you wouldn't come up with a complete road. You'd come up with a rough sample of that stretch of road, because they wouldn't peck every single bit. And they don't go peck, like that, right? They'd go peck, peck, space, peck, space. Yeah, Emily. Oh, very good. That's a good example. That's very good as well. Right. They don't have much of an end goal. They're doing it's somewhat, it's teleological, because they're trying to get at something, right? But there's not a big picture there, right? And that's sort of analogous to how there's not a big picture in this poem, except in the negative, right? There's a big picture, which is the war, but it sort of creeps up on you in the negative. Virtually, kind of. Yeah, that's a very good insight. Yeah, what's your name? Sorry, what's your name? Millie.
So, yeah. What I noticed first is that they're called hedge rovers, but
yeah.
We don't see a hedge. We don't, and they're pecking along the road, but we don't see what they're pecking. Like,
yeah.
Yes, they're eating, supposedly.
Yeah.
What are they eating?
Right.
Where do they live?
Right.
Why are they even there?
Right, right. There's something there, which is the food. We don't see the food, right? And maybe sometimes,
like the old men, we don't
very good,
see
very good, very good. So this is, I'm trying to get you into how Wordsworth is an ambient poet, right? He talks all the time about the surroundings around things rather than the things themselves. Hedgerow itself, right? Hedgerow itself, as was just pointed out, is a way to describe a road by describing what's around it. Right, the hedgerow. If you go to England, there are these really old, ancient, sometimes 1,000, 2,000-year-old hedgerows everywhere. You know, they all got quite destroyed in the 1790s, actually, by enclosure when they privatized the farms. But in this moment, there's these hedgerows, and they could be up to like 7, 10 feet tall, incredibly beautiful. You know, with all kinds of nests and birds and animals, and they're just like a really perfect ecosystem, right, from the Middle Ages and earlier. And these are the birds, right? They live in the hedgerow, right? So the hedgerow itself is a kind of surrounding, kind of ambient ecosystem, right? But it's not nothing, right? This is the point. It's not nothing. Do you remember that conversation? The difference between nothingness and nothing? Nothing is absolute void, not even nothing. Nothingness is a kind of cloudy something that is not that is an experience of nothing. Right? So what we're getting in this poem is a kind of nothingness, right? Like when you shade around the apple, it's not a void here, it's like a solid thing. But what's solid is the space around it, right? So there's something disturbing about that. It's disturbing because it's not directly something. You can't see it directly, but you can sort of detect it, right? Yeah, Angel.
I had an interesting, a little bit of an interesting, when you're talking about hedgerow birds.
Yeah. Oh, right on. Yeah, right on. Oh, the urgency, yes, absolutely. Right. Right. Right, right. That's right. Yeah. The hedgerow birds are probably sedge warblers or some kind of chickadee, you know. There's a kind of edge between what does it mean to be human, you know, or non-human. It's like the little pecking birds are like almost little machines, right? But in another way, they kind of sum up to this movement that the old man's doing. Like one individual bird is kind of anxiously pecking, but if you look at the entire crowd of birds, they kind of shimmer and kind of appear and disappear and vaguely move along as a kind of unit along the road, but you can't directly see them as a unit. So it's the same as the old man in a way. So I'm agreeing with you, but I'm sort of saying there's another level where some together the birds equal the old man a little bit, you know, because they're like little tiny movements that add up together to, like, walking is actually nothing's really happening from a Zeno's paradox point of view. Right, if you think that space is actually solid and it's made up of atoms, like here and here and here and here, when I move, you know, I'm just still, now I'm still again, now I'm still again, I'm never going to get to the other end, right, Zeno, yeah? So there's a kind of nothingness in movement, It's very hard to explain philosophically, actually. We see things moving all the time, but it's very hard to explain what the fuck that is. You know, if you think that things are absolutely themselves without contradiction. Yeah, what's your name?
Anna.
Anna, yeah.
I can respond to the
accident
of birds.
Yeah.
I'm an animal science major.
Right on. Right on. Sure, sure. Yeah. Okay, so what you're saying, there's a kind of, it's automated a little bit. It's automatic. See, this is the edge that Angel's talking about here, and I think you're talking about too, that the old man's activity seems automated, right? Like that, like it's not urgent. You know, but on the other hand, he's got this inner urge, right, that you can't see anywhere in the poem until you get to the end. You know, so Wordsworth's very interested in that edge because he's a little bit of a pantheist at this point. Pantheist? You know pantheist? God is not beyond reality. God is reality. Directly, right? This is God. This is God. This is God. This is God. Right? It's kind of a shocking Spinoza. Right? This is God. Yeah? So the birds are God. The old man is God. Yeah. What's your name again?
Rachel.
Richard, sorry.
I also feel like there's this kind of mix between how there's edge and nothingness and how sometimes the birds are actually pecking.
Yeah.
They're not pecking at something, they're just pecking at nothing.
Oh, very good. Right, because instinctively they might not actually always hit. They probably peck more than they eat because they're programmed, as it were, by their DNA to peck as much as possible, even when there's no food, right? Because sometimes they'll get food and sometimes they won't, right? And so we're looking again at a kind of excess over the empirical. You know, if they were totally in charge of themselves and were like, there's the food, I'm going to peck it, they wouldn't peck, right? But they are, but because they're not, right? So there's some kind of weird, it's like when you see a clockwork toy, it's uncanny because it's there's an excess of the inner mechanism of that toy over what it is externally, what it's doing, right? It brings up all these thoughts of, am I just a clockwork toy? You know, am I just a robot, right? We have to curtail this. I'm so sorry, because there's two people. Well, maybe Katrina, while I'm pulling up the next one.
I was thinking that I saw it as movement is the way to survive.
Oh, sure.
The man and the bird are both doing something that's progressing and forward to something.
Movement is a way to survive.
And the sun is the one laying house will.
Yeah. Right on. Very true. Very true. But what's interesting is the goal is not very teleological, as we've been exploring. You're just pecking for no particular reason, and then sometimes some food comes in your mouth, and so evolution likes that. Right? But you don't have to deliberately go for the food. That's the problem with life. It's a kind of rare form of death. Right? Like in a certain angle, like healthiness is a rare form of disease. You know, I was watching this amazing presentation the other day where the idea was that the space shuttle, that Challenger, developed intelligence, you know, before it blew up and analyzed these texts of Nietzsche. You know, it was a crazy, wacky. And so the space shuttle was in this very beautiful Ken Nordine sort of radio voice of this guy, you know. The ultimate one, he discovered reality is a rare form of disaster. But before that, it was intelligence is a rare form of stupidity, which I thought was very funny, right? But in this way, life is a kind of rare form of death, right? It's just mechanical repetition. The guy's just walking. He's not really trying to get there. That's the whole point. He looks like he's not getting anywhere from the narrator's point of view. He does have that goal, but looked at from another angle, he's just walking down the road, right? So it's kind of death. Beyond the war, right? Beyond the war with France, it's death, right? Because death, you can't see it anywhere in reality. Where is it? You can see corpses. You can have memories of dead people. You can possibly see ghosts. But where is death, right? On the other hand, it's incontestably true that things die. Yeah? Right? And when you mix it together with thinking about, you know, what is a life form, you soon realize, going all the way down to the DNA level and beyond, there's this weird lack of equilibrium, you know, that causes beings to kind of keep on repeating, and walking and pecking are repetition, right? DNA is trying to destroy itself, I think, right? When it unzips, ironically, it's an ironic romantic poem called DNA, right? DNA unzips, then because of the environment it's in with the ribosomes, it reproduces, right? Ironic. It's trying to get rid of itself. It doesn't want to reproduce, right? It's just mechanical, right? But there's some kind of... So the point is, death is before life, which is really disturbing. They were beginning to figure it out, right, in this kind of work, right? Death is before life. It's not the case that life appears and then it starts to die. The first thing that happens is this relentless repetition, mechanical rotation thing, whatever that is. Yeah, how come DNA even replicates at all, right? Because molecules must have that capacity. There are non-organic replicators, right? So the inorganic world, which is the world of death, comes before life. Yeah, but also it sort of is life. Life is like a kind of small region of it that we think of as metaphysically different, but really it's not that different. What's uncanny about the old man? He's like a walking corpse, right? You know, like shell shock. The thousand-yard stare, right? That whole deal is that you've experienced a trauma that you can't digest, so you're stuck in a repetition, right? You keep on thinking about the horrible thing that occurred to you, the car crash, the ugly split up, keeps going round and round and round. Yeah, repetition. Right, there was a boy. There was a boy. There was a boy. It is an Ancient Mariner. The little hedgerow birds that peck along the road regard him not. Same strategy. There was a boy, Ilya. Right? You knew him well, you cliffs and islands of Winanda. We're going to talk about the cliffs and islands of Winanda, this lake, beautiful lake district of northern England, where Wordsworth lived, in Grasmere, and so on. Many a time at evening when the stars had just begun to move along the edges of the hills, we're describing the atmosphere, the ambience around the boy. The stars, the edges of the hills, right? So was Werthian, yeah? Rising or setting, would he stand alone? Oh, now we can see the boy. He's standing alone beneath the trees or by the glimmering lake, right? We're connecting him metonymically. Wordsworth is a metonymy poet. Metaphor is when you... A trope is an algorithm, right? A trope is a kind of recipe for creating a certain kind of image. And the algorithm for creating a metaphor says, take a word, take a noun, now take another noun, now join them together with the word is, right? Doesn't necessarily get you a good metaphor, but that's how you do it. A trope is an algorithm, right? So a metonymy is take a noun, then take another noun that is the cause of that noun, right? And then substitute two for one, right? That's a metonymy. Cause could mean spatial proximity, right? A logical cause, or material cause, final cause, telos, efficient cause, how it works, right? So, you know, can I bum a smoke? Smoking is what I do to cigarettes. It's the efficient cause of smoking. So a smoke is a metonymy for a cigarette, right? Marmite, that delicious, horrifying substance of the English. It's named after the kind of casserole dish that the vegetables are boiled down in France, a marmite. Right, for reducing stock, right? It's a marmite, it's called marmite. Casserole, right? It's named after the dish that you make it in, right? Tim Morton, right, is a person called Tim. Your name is a metonymy for you, right? And so on and so on. And there, with fingers interwoven, both hands pressed closely, palm to palm, and to his mouth uplifted, this is a kind of spiritual, mystical, religious communion with non-human beings. Blew mimic hootings to the silent owls that they might answer him. Right, he's playing with these owls. And they would shout across the watery vale and shout again, repetition, shout, shout. Responsive to his call with quivering peals. Peal is a strong word. You know, because bells peal, church bells peal. Peal has a quality of almost like ripping open the fabric of existing somehow, peeling, peel, not like peel a banana, right, but the way something could resonate, peel. and long halloos. Halloo, we did halloo already, right? Halloo is what you say to a hunting dog, right? Or it's kind of ululation, right? Yeah, joyful, bliss, scary, wonderful, communion. And screams and echoes loud, redoubled and redoubled, repetition, 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 a wild scene of mirth and jocund din, right? Communion with nature. You all think romantic poetry is about that, right? But it's about that, but it's also about what happens next, right? It's about the coda, right? Communion with nature is just like one part of a much bigger movement that's got a lot more weirdness in it, right? And, right? Wordsworth's favorite linking word, and. Yeah? It could mean but. It could mean in addition to, moreover. It's ambiguous. Wordsworth is an ambiguity poet, right? Blake's kind of does the other way. Blake's a certainty poet. Blake shows you people who are totally certain, right? God is a lunatic. Tigers are evil. Lambs are innocent, right? Totally, total certainty. Wordsworth is a poet of uncertainty, right? That's why Wordsworth is such a good war poet, such a good trauma poet. Wordsworth's whole theory of poetry is that it's based on traumatic experience. Right? As he says in Lyrical Ballads, the overflow of powerful feelings recollected in tranquility. You have to have both. Overflow of powerful feelings, kapow, but then you also have recollected in tranquility. Repetition, revisiting, right? When you have a trauma, one of the things that happens is you're not sure if it's happening or not. Right? When you have a car crash, what? Crunch! Did that just happen? And you crash your car? Yeah? What just happened? You know, you get shot. I've never been shot, but I can imagine you're like, what? There's blood coming out of me. That should be on the inside, as Woody Allen says. Right? Trauma, precisely because it's very real, feels unreal. Right? So part of the sort of headspace of phenomenological experience of intense things like death and war is a feeling of unreality. Unreality. Right? Global warming gives us a feeling of unreality. Right? Uncertainty, uncanniness. Okay? When it chanced that pauses of deep silence mocked his skills. Nothing. Then sometimes in that silence while he hung listening, that's a genius bit, right? Hung listening. Hung, end of the line, gap, space, listening. You have to hang listening. You hang listening. Your eye hangs listening. A gentle shock of mild surprise has carried far into his heart, not would carry, which is what we would expect, right? In that silence while he hung listening, would have carried or would carry, but has carried, that kind of implies it's already there, right? Romantic poets are trying to see things that are already there, right? Like Kant is trying to see things in your mind that is already there. Before you see it, before you look, right? Before you look in the mirror, the demon is already there in the mirror, right? Before you look under the bed, Bob is already hiding behind the bed, right? Before you look outside the bathroom, the ghost of the sixth sense is already behind the door in the bathroom, already there. Right, stuff that's already there is experienced as a kind of unreal, you know, hallucinatory, dreamlike, precisely because it's real, because it's already there. Right, has carried far into his heart the voice of mountain torrents. So the real communion, right, this is what Wordsworth was saying, right, the real communion has already happened. Already. Right? There's already some kind of beautiful line. Hazlitt thought this was really beautiful. And De Quincey actually thought this was a really beautiful line. Sorry, De Quincey. A gentle shock of mild surprise has carried far into his heart the voice of mountain torrents, or the visible scene would enter unawares into his mind. That's very Wordsworthian. The visible scene doesn't give you any detail. It's just something that he was seeing, some shit that he was seeing, and the whole thing is a reaction shot. Right? So this is how it works. First of all, there's a bit of a narrative about the boy. then there's a reaction shot that creeps up on you by seeming to be not a reaction shot until about three lines later, right? Then sometimes in that silence while he hung listening, right, all of a sudden you realize, oh my gosh, he's having an experience. Now we're not looking at the owls, we're looking at the boy's face. Or the visible scene would enter unawares into his mind with all its solemn imagery, its rocks, its woods, and that uncertain heaven received into the bosom of the steady lake. If I was doing a movie of it, that would all be the boy's face, right? You wouldn't be seeing the lake, you'd just be looking at the boy's reaction, which is a kind of non-conceptual, Kantian, wow. Right? Wow. My inner space connected to the outer space. Full stop. Blank. Gap. Gapsploitation. Irony. Weird. The reaction shot wasn't the end. It could have been the end of the poem, right? This would be a good enough. Boom. That would be a good enough ending. I strongly advise when you do your close reading to mess with the poem like that. Change the words, change the space, change the lineation. That would already be an amazing poem. Then there's this other bit. Now we refocus. Wait a minute, where did the boy go? Where's the boy? Fair of the woods and beauties is the spot, the vale where he was born. What? Where's the lake? Where's the boy? Where are the owls? This is a total scene change. Where's the boy? I was just focalizing through the boy. Where's he gone? The churchyard? What the fuck, this churchyard? What churchyard, what? The churchyard. It's Wordsworthian, right? It is an ancient mariner. Regard him not. The churchyard? What churchyard? If he said a churchyard, it'd be totally different. Right? The churchyard, it's already there. Wow, what? What's happening? Disorientation. Right? Weird. Slightly unreal. Hangs upon a slope above the village school. On a slope. What? Now I'm standing on this sloping thing. I'm not by the lake. I'm above the village school. I'm being located as the reader in a kind of anamorphic space. Right? First of all, it's a graveyard. Second of all, I'm on a slope. I'm above the village school. It's a totally different location all of a sudden. And there along that bank, when I have passed at evening, I believe that near his grave. What the fuck? He's dead? Where did he die? His death was already there from the beginning of the poem. Oh, fuck. This isn't about the boy. This is about the narrator. This is about Wordsworth, or the narrator, whatever, the first-person narrator. The near his grave, a full half hour together. There's another reaction shot. I have stood mute, for he died when he was 10 years old. So the whole reaction shot of the boy is actually subsumed into this other reaction shot of the narrator. Now that's called romantic irony. Right? My favorite kind of irony. I don't know why. It gives me the flesh creeping, hair standing up on my body thing. Very healthy. Because it's when the narrator of the poem realizes, or you realize, that the narrator, who is ontologically outside the narrative, right? Jane Austen isn't a character in her own story, is the lead character of the story, right? It's an Oedipus plot, right? Oedipus is the detective. He finds out he's the criminal. He's tracing himself. Whoever saw that amazing A Scanner Darkly, the Philip K. Dick, should watch it. It's a few years ago now. Really strange animation. And Keanu Reeves is a character. He's a narc, right? He's trying to get the drug kingpin, or the drug manufacturer. He realizes that it's him, but he's so high on this drug that he's addicted to, he doesn't know it's him. He finds out that it's him. It's completely strange, right? It's a kind of Mobius strip. Oedipus is the criminal, but he doesn't know he's the criminal. He's the detective. Deckard is chasing the replicant, then he finds out he is the replicant. Right? That's romantic irony. Right? Where all of a sudden, something that seemed to be outside the story actually turns out to be inside the story. That's why it's so powerful, because it's saying that there's no outside of reality. Wherever you go, as Buckaroo Banzai, that great 80s philosopher, used to say, there you are. Right? There you are. There was a boy. You're already there. Yeah, one more. Angel.
Can you tell
It's possible. But even if that's true, Angel, you can only see that with 20/20 hindsight. You can only see it backwards. And that's the uncanny strangeness of the poem, right? You can only see the truth of it backwards. It doesn't tell you forwards, it tells you backwards. Okay, that's it. Good observations.